Welcome to the Resilience Rising podcast with me, your host, Jen Scottney. With the help of my guests, we will be getting curious about what resilience is, how we develop it, and the times we've used it. This podcast is here to explore all things resilience. Today, I'm so excited to chat to James Wythe, better known as Healthy Living James. James is a qualified health coach, cookbook author, and full-time food blogger with over 1 million followers. Growing up, James was incredibly sporty, and when he was 12, he started to fall in love with golf and wanted to be a professional golfer when he grew up. But on the 4th of December 2010, life took a dramatic turn for James when he fell ill, seemingly overnight. It would be an illness that left him bedbound for 2 years and housebound for the next 4 years. He was diagnosed with ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, and faced debilitating symptoms including weight loss, extreme sensitivities, and insomnia. With the help of his family and a nutritionist, his story is one of recovery, albeit very gradually. During his recovery, he taught himself to cook from scratch and later started sharing his recipes. With his book released in 2022 and his huge following of fans of his simple, dairy and gluten-free recipes, this was how Healthy Living James came to be the huge success he is today. Welcome, James.
Oh, thanks for that lovely intro.
Oh, thank you. And just thank you for all your recipes as well, because that's how I found you, as a vegan, gluten-free cooker, and thinking there was absolutely nothing I could eat, and you've shown me that there's so many amazing dishes that I can cook.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's quite surprising actually now how you say, I've been doing it for about 12 years now, or being gluten and dairy free for 12 years, and the market has drastically changed in that time. And it's, I remember when I started 12 years ago, I felt like there was nothing for me to eat, and now, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you want. Like, there's so much out there now, product wise and recipe wise and inspiration. So
yes, because I mean, your recipes, they're cooking with real food as well, aren't they? And I never thought that I would be cooking gluten-free vegan cheesy dough balls with like three ingredients, which I do from your cookbook.
Yeah, I love that recipe.
That's definitely the one with the most like stains in my
how's it
in the cookbook, because I've made it so many times.
I wanted to, when I was making that cookbook, it was like one of my main goals was to, you know, get people to use it constantly. It wasn't just like a book that would look pretty on the shelf. It was always designed to be like abused, really, and like ripped pages, stained pages. Like, that means that people are using it. And I've popped into friends' homes and people have brought me their book to sign when I'm at events and stuff, and it's always lovely to see when it's actually being used.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too bad. I've got it here, but it is definitely got some marks on for the recipes that I've come back to time and time again. And I was also not only inspired by your recipes, but your story as well. And for me, when I started getting curious about resilience, I speak to people who have done amazing things, cycled around the world and done all these challenges. But for me and my own resilience, I think the days that I was tested were when I was chronically ill and stuck in bed, because it just required, it's so much resilience to just show up every day. And so hearing your story was really inspirational to me. And I just wondered what your view on resilience is, and what that means to you.
Yeah, exactly what you said. Like, I guess it means different things to different people, but to me it was about that turning up every day and kind of accepting that it wasn't going how you wanted. Like, you know, I fell ill when I was 21. It's not a great time. It's never a great time, but like the age of 21 is not optimal, is it? Like, you should be doing other things, having fun. So for me, the sort of resilience side was just kind of accepting that it wasn't how it should be, but also just carrying on. Like, and people often ask me how I got through that stage, and I mean, you don't really have a massive choice, do you? Like, I didn't have a choice. I wasn't like choosing to be in bed. Like, I would rather have been doing something else, but it was, I just kept going, really. And luckily I had the support of my family. So when I was bedbound for those 2 years, my mum, and I was back home with my parents, and my mum was like my full-time carer for those 2 years. So I luckily had that support. And now my wife, Louisa, used to come and visit me as well. So they kept me going a bit and kept me positive, but generally pretty positive person as well. So that's definitely helped.
Do you think you were a positive person before your illness? So when I was talking about you as a sporty teenager.
Yeah, I always was sort of that sort of overachiever type personality. So when it came to golf, like I sort of believed that I could get where I wanted to get. You know, it was all down to me. Like if I had I could get there if I wanted to, type thing. So I always felt like that growing up, and golf helped massively with that as well. Like it's a lot about being in the moment, also forgetting about what's just happened. Like if you had a bad hole, you always get on with the next hole. And I guess it related a lot to being ill. Like if I had a bad day, I'd accept that and get on with the next day and hope for the best with that. So golf really helped me mentally deal with a lot of those things.
So tell us about, I said in the intro that your life changed overnight, and that's definitely not my experience of chronically ill. I was always more gradual, it crept up. So it sounds just awful what you went through. But tell us about that night where it did just change and what the differences were.
I went out for dinner with friends in Bournemouth. That's where I'm from. Normal night, went out for dinner, had I think a couple drinks. I wasn't, you know, really drinking much. And I stayed on a friend's sofa actually in Bournemouth. And I woke up the next day and my neck felt awful, like really bad, really stiff. And I thought I was probably just from sleeping on the sofa, you know, normal things. But then I felt really dizzy and sick, disorientated. And I thought I'd just got to go home. So I drove home. And then I was actually sick for a few days. And then on and off for a few weeks. And I thought I'd just had food poisoning. Like it was that sudden. And I'd had food poisoning in the past. Like it felt exactly the same to me. So that was how overnight it was. Like I was fine one night, next day feeling sick, being sick. And then I just didn't get better from there. Like I was on and off sick for a few weeks. Had no energy, just felt terrible. But you sort of just, at that stage, I didn't really accept it, I guess. I was just like, oh, you know, we'll carry on like everyone does. Like you just sort of get on with it and you think, oh, I will get better, so it'll be fine. And then I kept pushing for about a month or two. And I actually went on holiday with my parents up north. And I just had to lay down for most of the week, which was so unlike me. And we got home from holiday and I just was so ill, and my parents just sort of thought that this wasn't right. Like this was so abnormal for me to be like this. I'd lost, you know, quite a bit of weight even in those first month or two, and I wasn't even able to stand at this point. Like, you know, that's how bad it had gotten. And my dad had to physically carry me into the doctor's for surgery at that point. And I remember the doctor talking to me. I can even remember it now. And he was asking me loads of questions and I couldn't talk properly. Like, and I just said ambulance. That was the only word I could say. And they got an ambulance down and rushed me in for a suspected brain tumor. So I was kept in for a few weeks, had all the brain scans, had every test you can imagine, and nothing came back. Everything was fine, and they just said that it's probably a viral illness and that I would go home and get better, basically. And then from that point I was in bed for 2 years, so I didn't really, it wasn't a very quick recovery. It's quite a long one. And then onto the housebound stage of about 3 to 4 years, so it was very long.
Yes. And I've been in a similar period, and just I find it really hard to describe to other people what it's like, because for me, that being bedbound, it's not like I'm just resting in bed. Like, I just want nothing more than to just walk out of bed. But for me, it just felt like I was completely pinned to the bed, like somebody was just lying on me, and I just felt so ill. And I guess during that point, did you still have hope that you would get better? It seems like that would be, for me, I didn't always have hope that I would get better. It was just too much.
Yeah, I on and off. Like, I definitely remember times where I was just like, what? Like, why me? Why has this happened? Am I going to recover? I definitely remember thinking that. I mean, that's totally normal as well, because it was so out the blue, and you just don't really, I mean, there wasn't a lot of hope. Like, there wasn't, it wasn't like, I wasn't getting loads of support from the doctors. I wasn't really getting many answers. So I didn't really have hope there from other people, which normally helps. You know, normally you have someone to, like, even looking, you know, the whole climate has changed dramatically from, you know, if we go back 12 years, there wasn't really social media as such as it like it is now. You couldn't just go online and type in or find someone that was going through the same thing as you and just be inspired by them. That wasn't really happening. It was more sort of forums and places like that and Facebook groups and things. So it wasn't as simple as it is now to find, like, someone to look up to and see how they've done it. And, you know, now that's one of the positives of social media, I think, is that you can find someone to like, you know, you found my stuff.
Yeah.
And the stories resonated with you. Whereas back then it wasn't really like that. And I found the community quite negative, actually. The sort of forums and the Facebook groups, and it was always not a great place to be. So I actually removed myself from a lot of that, because I didn't, although people, it was great to hear that people were going through the same as me. They were often quite like, oh, this is it. And it's still the same in those communities now. Like, I've been involved in a few things talking about ME and my recovery, and people will always just be like, well, you can't recover from that. Like, I've got this for life. Like, and although I don't really say that I'm fully recovered, because I do go up and down. And since having our daughter in the last sort of year and a half, I've had big setbacks. Like, I go up and down quite a lot now, which is down to sleep deprivation probably, and just, you know, a bit more stress and more pressure and, you know, things that other people face having a family. So I've found it hard in the last 18 months. So I'll never say that I'm fully recovered, and I always have to be mindful, but having the mindset that you're going to be ill forever is not a great way to think.
I've had exactly the same experience as well, and I found that some of the forums and places where chronically ill people were, it did give me some good leads in terms of, I saw people with hypermobility and I saw people with similar things, and I could go down little bits of my own research, because like you, I wasn't getting any support from any doctors or healthcare providers at all. But I also found that mindset of, I will always be ill, really hard to deal with. Like, sometimes, and I really swung between, do I accept this? Would my life be easier if I just accepted that this is how it would be, and I learned to live with that? Or do I have hope that I get better? And I think for me, it depended how much energy I had, because the hope took more energy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do have very little energy at that point, don't you? I mean, I remember that I couldn't even, you know, things that you take for granted, like I couldn't even read a text message. I mean, that's how, you know, I couldn't read a sentence. Like, that's how drained I was. I couldn't watch TV. And, you know, when you're not ill and you watch TV, you're like, well, it's actually quite a relaxing, non-energetic thing. But when you're in that state, any type of moving object is actually just drains, can drain you. So I often was just laying there for for days on end without doing anything. It's not like I could even really have a conversation with, in my worst points, I wouldn't even talk. Like, I just didn't have the energy to talk. And it's like what you said, it feels like someone's just laying on you. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, there's no energy there to give anything.
Yeah. And also those things, again, like I couldn't watch TV or listen to the radio or anything, listen to music even. But these are sort of, these would be good distraction things to take us away from how we're actually feeling. So a lot of the times I was just lying in bed with my thoughts. That was the only thing that I had and they weren't pleasant at that time.
No, it can be really difficult. You go very up and down with it. And like you say, those distractions would help massively, but you just, you know, and when I try to think back of, you know, how I was feeling in certain times, like every day just felt the same. Like I felt like 2 years just merged into a few days. Like when I think back, I can't really pick out many sort of specific days or thoughts that much. Like it just felt like one long day, but over 2 years.
And this is at a time where you're still in your early 20s and all your friends, I don't know whether they were off to uni or having jobs and having a life. And for me, it was a time where my friends I couldn't see them because I couldn't go and socialize, and they didn't really know. Like I'd get messages, are you better now, and things like that. And so for me it was very isolating, and I can imagine being at that young age it was even more so that you were back with your parents.
I lost quite a few friends. I also, some of my closer, well, most of my friends, I wouldn't even allow them to come visit me actually, because I just didn't want, they sort of knew who I was before and I didn't want that judgment from them. It was easier for me to actually, you know, because having someone come round, you feel like you've got to give it energy as well. I just didn't have it. Like, I didn't have the energy to talk to someone or like pretend to be better than I was. Because that's probably what a lot of people feel like. You, even now when I get people round, you sort of, you feel like you've got to perform a little bit, don't you? I feel like you've got to give a bit of energy to things, and at that point I just didn't have it to give. But one of the only people I'd actually allowed to come visit me was Louisa, and I think that was partly because I didn't feel as judged by someone that didn't know me properly, so she didn't really know what I was like before I was ill, so I didn't feel as judged. And some people would find that the other way around, they'd prefer like close friends around them because they feel safer, I guess. But for me, it was the opposite. I just would prefer someone to be around that didn't really know who I was before. So that's what I found easier.
Louisa, so much love for that story that she came and visited you, and now you're married. Yeah. So the dark days were there, but there was a glimmer of light because you started to see some improvement, which thank God that you did. How did that come about, that you did see that little bit, some improvement?
So around 6 to 8 month mark of being ill, my mum was always so active in my story and my recovery and always looking at things and researching things. She was just not going to give up, which was, you know, vital really. So she had a nutritionist come out to visit me. She would sit in my room whilst I was in bed, and we would talk through everything, and we slowly started taking some supplements. I cut out gluten and dairy, and obviously my mum had to do all that, the cooking. We were not far off from it anyway. Like my mum's been vegetarian for like 40 or 50 years or something, so she was always quite conscious of ingredients. She had to make a few changes to that, but we did some supplements, and I had to do that very slowly because I'd had some severe allergic reactions to medication I was given throughout the sort of 6 months. A couple times I was put back in hospital because of those reactions. So I was so scared to, my body was just hypersensitive to anything. So I was too scared to even take vitamin C at the start. Like, it was that bad. And I slowly built up, you know, taking those and the food and just like resting, you know, trying to rest better than I was before, you know, being a bit more mindful of that and accepting that I couldn't do what I used to do helped as well. And I, after about a year of being bed bound, I stepped foot outside for the first time. And it felt crazy, like I literally stepped outside and it felt like I'd obviously been in my room 99% of the time and four walls around me. The step outside felt crazy. I still remember it now. Like, everything just felt so big, just was a weird feeling. And obviously coming from playing golf, I used to be outside all the time. So that felt quite overwhelming, but I just gradually would do little things, you know, walking down to the end of the drive and back. I remember going to a small little Tesco for the first time with Louisa, walked around, found it very like overwhelming, noisy. And I was, you know, I had to learn to do things again and be in around people, because I'd been not around people for the only place I'd been was a hospital. So being around people and noise and those type of things, I had to learn to do again. And people probably will relate to that now from COVID, like people are locked up for so long. It's actually quite hard to go back to being in social environment. So I found that quite difficult. But yeah, I just slowly did little step-by-step things and didn't overdo things. I think that was really important for me. Like, I knew what my limits were and didn't try to go past them, which is great when you're chronically ill, but also when you're just sort of day to day, like I am now, it's good to try and push a little bit outside the limits. So it was quite difficult to do, because I had come from playing golf and always pushing the limits to then knowing where, like, I just felt like I was good at knowing what I could and couldn't do and accepting that, which was really crucial. Because I know a lot of people just, they'll start, maybe one day you feel a little bit better and they'll just go overboard, and then they'll be going backwards. So it's like one step forward, 10 back. But I was always quite good at really managing myself with that.
And when you were going into hospital, you mentioned a few things there. What was was it similar to that first period that you described, where they do all the tests and tell you, woohoo, you're normal, everything's great?
Mm. Yeah, pretty
was
much.
Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, I had a few, like I was saying, the allergic reactions to some medication. And I remember one of the times they were asking me sort of questions, whether I was, you know, hearing things, seeing things, basically implying, like, was I going crazy? Mm. And yeah, I just didn't get a lot of support with it, which was pretty disappointing. I hope that it's improved a bit now for people, because back then it was pretty bad. I think awareness for it has risen quite a lot. But I still think it's quite a misunderstood condition, and I guess it's when I describe it to people now, it feels quite a blanket term that's chucked over people. You know, I was probably completely different to you.
Yeah,
like what was causing it to me was probably completely different to you. So I understand it from like the medical side, like how can you treat something that you don't actually know what the real reason is. But they also don't try and help you find that real reason. You have to try and do that privately, which is hard work.
Yeah, I know. I feel exactly the same. I mean, for me, and still the same as far as I'm aware. It's we've done other tests, nothing else has shown up. You've had this unexplained fatigue for, in my case, it was over 6 months. And so we'll give you this diagnosis. But it really didn't help me, because once I got the diagnosis, it shut the door to any other investigations, any other referrals. So I never went to a hospital. I never saw anybody past my GP other than people that I paid for.
Yeah. And that I feel like that is part of the reason why that title is there, because it kind of allows them to close the door on you. It's the easy route out, which is annoying.
Yeah, I really hope it's changed. And I don't think it's changed in terms of treatment yet, but there seems to be a lot more research, because like you, this was before COVID when I was ill, and there was barely any studies. And the ones that were looking at the psychological factors that I could find. And just thinking of back to that resilience of showing up every day, turning up every day, did it make it more difficult that you were almost being like people weren't believing you that you were ill? It certainly for me made me question, hang on, am I depressed? Are they right? Is that all that's wrong with me? But I was like so sure. I knew I wasn't. I was ill first. And so, yeah, how did that affect your resilience?
I definitely had periods of that. Like I felt the same when it came to the depression side. Like it got to a point where I actually, that was one of the medications that put me back in hospital. I took antidepressants because I didn't know that it was just sort of, they said, do you think you could be depressed? And I was like, well, I don't think so. Like, but this had been 9 months or 10 months and thought, well, maybe I am. I don't know. Like, I thought that I was only depressed because of what had happened to me, but maybe this was that and I didn't know. And I was pretty naive to it, I guess. So I took antidepressants and they put me in hospital. I had like a severe allergic reactions to them and they put me back there. And you just don't, at that period you're so desperate, aren't you? I was like, maybe I am, maybe this will just completely transform my life overnight, but that wasn't the case. So yeah, I didn't feel heard or believed, which was quite frustrating. I mean, I know some doctors were a little, because of my history, and you know, I was so far from being like lazy or in, you know, hiding away inside, I think maybe they believed me a little bit more, I don't know. But I didn't really feel heard much. But I guess it did impact me, but also I sometimes just didn't care. I was like, I know that I don't want to lay in this bed. Like, I absolutely don't want to be here. So I knew that deep down, like, this was real. But it was quite hard to grasp that there was no sort of set cure to it, and like you, the diagnosis didn't really mean much to me, because it doesn't really give you an answer at all.
No, it doesn't explain anything, or it doesn't forward any treatment. It, for me, it was just a label rather than a diagnosis. And now with hindsight, I mean, we'll go through a bit more of your recovery, but do you have any answers about why this happened to you, or is that just not a question that you're even asking anymore?
I never actually found out the real reason. I had so many tests done, a few sort of things came back with I had potentially active Epstein-Barr virus, which is often a trigger for a lot of people, but I never really gotten a detailed answer as to what it was. Definitely this or definitely that. I didn't have that at all. No.
And you talked about those little milestones when you started recovery, the first time outside, the first time for a walk. Were you celebrating these? Because it's hard, isn't it, when you've been so fit and active and used to play golf and used to walk to Tesco without even thinking about it. And in a sense, it sometimes made me sad that this is all I had to celebrate. But I'm I realize that I have to celebrate those now because it really helps with my journey. And I just wondered whether, yeah, were these happy times that you could see this improvement?
I definitely felt like a sense of achievement after doing those. I've always been pretty bad with praising myself. I'm still not great now, to be honest. Even when I was winning lots of golf tournaments, I was always like very, yeah, okay, what can I win next? I wasn't like that. I guess I wasn't that present when I was making achievements, and I'm still like that now. It's something I probably need to try and improve on. But I remember, especially the first few times going out, like I felt like I'd achieved something, and those little things keep you going, don't they? Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, they give you a bit of purpose. And hope, that was what it was. And a lot of these things come down to hope, really, don't they? Like if you are given like a glimpse of where you can go, then that helps a lot.
Yeah, for me, I had some acupuncture, not when I was really bad towards the end, but when I first started getting ill. And it was like a little switch for me, and it really gave me hope. It's so much easier to hope when you've got something, some evidence in front of you, or it was for me.
Yeah, definitely.
And did you still have hope of a full recovery when you, because, you know, we talk about this recovery, but this is over years. They must have been really, really difficult to see to anybody else about these little improvements. Did you have hope that it would keep going?
Yeah, I thought that I could. I've always felt like that I'd have to be somewhat careful. Like I knew that I wouldn't be able to live, like do anything I want, and not have to even think about it. But I always felt like I could get to a point where I can do pretty much what I want. That's what I had in my mind, where I could get back to playing golf and, you know, have a kid and do the things that I want to do. But I always also thought that I've never worried about going backwards that much, but I always thought that I would have to be a little bit more cautious than someone that hasn't been what I've been through, type thing.
And you talked a bit about some of the kind of psychological aspects. So you'd been this high achiever, and then suddenly pushing through doesn't help when you're chronically ill, or it definitely didn't for us, did it? And so, yeah, I felt like I had a similar facing up to do that actually, well, I might not get this lovely simple answer of why I got ill, but I was looking at what I had and the stresses in my life at the time. And I had to face up to this perfectionism, this people pleasing, and with that came a lot of blame. Did I make myself ill? And I've had to turn that into compassion, in that I was just doing the best that I could at the time. And I wondered whether there was those psychological factors and those mindset issues that you had to face up to, which is so hard, as well as the physical symptoms.
It's interesting because a lot of people that I've spoken to that have been through this are overachieving, people pleasing,
never asking for help, not delegating.
Yeah, and that's exactly me. Like that is my personality as well. We'll always sort of say yes if I can, always try and help when sometimes I should say no. And that's interesting that there's a lot, it impacts a lot of people that are like that. And I'm not sure why, but yeah, maybe it's because we just burn the candle from both ends. Like you just get to a point where your body's just like, no, you've done enough here. So I have improved with that. Like I'm definitely more in my own lane with that, and I know what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And I've improved with saying no to things. I think maybe that's like with the business, with it growing, and I can say no to things now, and that's okay. So I think that I've improved a bit with that. And also, you know, if I'm not, since, like I say, having my daughter, and if I'm not feeling okay, some days I will just pull the plug on on things and just say, no, I'm not doing anything today, like, or I'm not going to go out and do this or that. So I have improved with that, but I did struggle, like you say, mentally with, have I put myself here? Is it because of my personality that I've got to this stage? Because I am still quite a sensitive person, and, you know, going through being a parent, I feel like that sensitivity has made it harder for me as a dad as well. Like, so I know I've got friends that are dads that just don't worry that much. You know, they just go out, do what they do, and they come back. And whereas I'm very involved, and I take everything in quite personally and find things quite tough to deal with as well. So I think that's just me.
Well, I was going to ask you about your resilience in terms of dealing with social media. Yeah. If you've got, it sounds like that would be really hard to have that sensitive personality when you've got so many followers. And I can't imagine that they're all positive. I mean, you've just got so many.
Yeah. No, you do get some hate. It's interesting because social media isn't in my personality type at all. Like the personalities that are usually on social media that do well are very, you know, quite high energy, very look at me, attention. And that's just not me at all. And that I always found that a difficulty at the start when I started it all, the blog like 7 or so years ago, was I would rather just be hidden, you know, in a corner somewhere, whereas I had to learn to open up and not be such an introvert. Like, social media is designed for extroverts, yeah. Really. So I have always struggled with that. But just a lot of what kept me going on social media was people making the recipes and the positive feedback. And yeah, no doubt I've had some hate, and I'm probably quite minimal compared to a lot of people in my position, I'd say, follower position. But I also don't antagonize hate, I guess. I don't sort of bring it on myself, but I do get some, because, you know, you can always offend people with anything now.
Yes. and when you've got that many people following you, it's just statistically you're going to get it, aren't you, surely?
Yeah. And it's not so much the followers, actually. It's more the you do get some, but it's more the people that don't follow you, actually, that you, because you're still opening yourself up, like, to social media, pushing out your content to random people. Yes. So you're going to get the hate that I generally get is from people that don't follow.
Yeah. I guess it's more you've just got that high visibility because of the number of followers. So tell me how the blog started then. So we've got that you were describing that you were having these incremental little wins and going out, and part of the recovery had been that you were following this gluten-free and dairy-free diet. So how did that come about that then you started sharing what you were doing and eating and cooking?
So if we go past the bedbound stage, about 2 year mark, Louisa and I moved into an apartment together, and she was out working, trying to sort of pay the rent. And I was at home, mainly sofa bound at this point. I'd either be in bed or on the sofa, but I had to obviously cook. My mum was cooking for me before, so I had to teach myself how to cook. So I had a chair in the kitchen, and I would sit on there and chop things up, and I'd have supermarket deliveries, and they used to carry all the ingredients into the kitchen for me, so I'd put things away and make recipes up. And like I said earlier, 12 years ago, there's recipe wise it's not like it is now. Like, there's not hundreds and thousands of books or websites or social media people to follow. It wasn't really like that at all, so I really had to teach myself how to cook, really, and how to chop. And I didn't really have much previous experience in it at all. And so I just built up like our favorite recipes. And as I was slowly progressing through that 4 year period of being mainly housebound, family, friends would come round, I'd cook, and they wanted me to share the recipes. And it got to a point where I thought it was easier to actually put the recipes on a website so that I could just give them the website, you go there, you get the recipe, rather than having to text it to people, write it down or whatever. I just felt like it was the easiest way to share recipes that would reduce my energy, you know, with giving it and that. So I set up the website. It took about 9 months to put 30 recipes on there because I was still probably only 40% recovered at this point. And I'd never taken a photo of food in my life. And they were pretty bad back then.
Are they still on there? Can we go back?
No, actually, I think some of them, I've gone back through the website over the last like year and re-updated pretty much all the recipes. But I probably got some somewhere hidden in some folder somewhere, but they were pretty bad.
It's fine. We were all putting out bad photos and content back then.
Yeah. So then I set up the website, set up all social media at that same time, and built quite a quick following on Instagram, probably built 5,000 followers in the first few months of doing it, maybe 2 or 3 months.
And were you sharing your story in terms of your illness at that point, or was it just the recipes?
Bit of both. Like, okay. I had a bit of my story. I think that helped resonate with people. And because the food space back then was so heavily female dominated, I mean, there just wasn't any real guys that weren't chefs. You know, there was like obviously Jamie Oliver and the big TV chefs, but there was no like just sort of normal home cook type person. So I think that probably helped as well. And even now, actually, social media wise, there's loads of guys in the space. But if you Google certain recipes, you'll 95% of the time you'll come across a female. Like, it's still heavily dominated in the sort of recipe blog side. And I can only probably name about 5 guys that do food blogs, which, you know, it's not many.
I'm just thinking to the recipes that I go to, and you're right, the ones online, they are generally female.
Yeah. So but the whole space has just changed dramatically. I mean, social media has gone from, well, my main focus over those 7 years has always been Instagram, and it, you know, it's gone from all about pictures to then all about stories and then all about videos. I've been through all of those progressions.
And how much do you enjoy that progression and playing the algorithms? Or ultimately, do you just want to share your recipe and your story and not bother with all the rest of it?
More so recently, I've felt like that. I think it's just because I've been through all of those transitions where I remember when stories came out. I mean, stories are so normal now, aren't they? Like, yeah. It's just... people would be like, what? I don't even know what would do without it. But I remember when they came about 5.5 years ago, probably maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I would stand there for, I remember standing there for an hour to do a 15-second video. Like, it was that bad. And then obviously it all transitioned from photos to videos. And I got on that quite quick. Like, I think Reels came out around about when COVID started ish. And I was very quick to get on the videos, and I did well from that. Social media is all about getting on the trends as quick as you can, getting on the latest thing that they want to promote. You know, they want Reels to do well when they come out, so they're going to push them. And I did well from doing that. Now, I found it difficult with running the website and running social media because they're two different, completely different recipes. Like, social media is very much about what's cool and something a bit different or quirky to grab someone's attention, whereas the website is all about recipes that people are actually going to make, because when you go to Google and search bolognese, for example, you're going there with the intent to make that recipe, Whereas on social media, it's a lot about entertainment and inspiration, and you're probably never going to make it. Like, a lot of people won't make a video that they see on socials, but they'll think, oh, that's quite nice, but don't actually action it that often. I mean, people have made lots of my recipes from Instagram, but if you can, you know, add the numbers up, it's a completely different recipe that you're creating. So I have found that quite difficult with doing that. Like, I don't have a big team of people around me. Like, it's me, and I freelance a little bit of work out. So I found that difficult. And to go at the pace that you need to on socials is really hard work. Like, it's a full-time job on its own to keep up with it. So I have, over the last 6 months, found it more difficult. And actually, I haven't posted a reel for about a month now, just trying to have a little bit of thinking space and downtime with that, because it's quite intense. Because it's not just about the actual cooking the recipe, it's the editing of it, it's the interacting with people on it, it's all the mental strain around that. So it's quite a lot.
And you said earlier that you didn't count yourself as fully recovered. So I guess you're doing this with maybe less energy, or with just more conscious that you don't want to burn out. And I know there's been times where I've wanted to ask you on the podcast, and then, like, literally that post has been, or your story has been, that you've just feeling a bit burnt out and you're just going to step back for a bit. And I just think, okay, I don't want to add anything to that. So
yeah.
How do you look after yourself? Is it just taking time out? Is it being more discerning about what you say yes to?
I think so. And that has improved. Like, social media has always been quite hard for me to step back from, because you sort of feel like, okay, well, I've spent all this time building it. I don't want to, like, not turn up now, and then potentially the algorithm or people forget about you. So I have found that tough over the years. But I guess since having Arlen, who's our daughter, my mindset has changed with that a bit, I guess. Like, I want to do things that, you know, the whole reason why I started it in the first place was because I enjoyed making recipes and sharing them. So I never want to try and lose that. It's a difficult balance to get. It is difficult. So I look after myself by not always feeling the pressure to post something. And that has dramatically improved, because if I'd said 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, that I wouldn't have posted a video for a month, that would have just been like, wow. I was posting like 5 a week. So yeah, I think I've improved with that. And also, I'm pretty good at realizing how the spaces are changing. And there's, since probably the last 2 years, the influx of people making recipe videos is like, the numbers would be mind-blowing, like how much it's gone up. So there's a huge influx of people coming into the space, and it's changing quite dramatically. And I'm usually quite good at seeing what's happening and trying to make a shift to be different. And go, like, I actually feel like food blogs used to be the main thing. Then social media took over, and I actually think, give it 5 years, we'll be all back to websites and not getting recipes on socials. So yeah, I feel like I'm quite early with that, and I'm sharing a bit of info there that if people are creating recipes just on socials, I would try and move away from that, because I think it's going to really go back to websites for people. I think might be wrong on that, but yeah.
And so along the way, it went from sharing your recipes to family and friends, to then now it's an income for you, and a vocation and a career. And how do you feel about that? Like, I've had some guests on the podcast who say what this traumatic thing that happened to me was a gift because I wouldn't be doing any of this without it. Do you feel like it's a gift that you got ill, or is it just still just showing up and making the best and accepting what happened to you?
Both. I think that I obviously wouldn't be here without being ill. Don't know what I'd be doing, but maybe
it might be a super rich golfer.
Maybe. I mean, I that would have been very difficult. Like, golf is incredibly hard, like insanely hard to get to the top. I think that I wouldn't be here without this. Like, I wouldn't have met Louisa. I wouldn't have got married to her. And I wouldn't have set up what I've done and brought out a cookbook and things like that. So I feel like, I wouldn't say I was like lucky, you know, lucky to get it, because I wouldn't want to go back there. But also, it's got me where I am now, and I'm proud of where I've got to from what I've been through. You know, it's been quite a journey. So I feel fortunate from that side. And, you know, there's a lot of people that go through this that don't really get out the other side of it that well either. So I feel fortunate from that side. So yeah, bit of both. Like, I feel like it's helped me, it changed me as a person mentally, made me tougher. And things have happened in my life that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for being that way. So, yeah.
Yeah, you referred to some setbacks that you'd had. And do you feel that it's given you a resilience that you can use in other areas of your life going forward? I definitely feel like my illness did.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's made me tougher with those and being more resilient to everything, really. Like, it's had a huge impact mentally that most people that go through big things, it often takes something big in your life to do that, doesn't it? Like, you, it's all about life experiences, and going through something like that at a young age did make a difference. Like, it has made a difference to me. So, yeah.
And one thing that I mentioned before as well, before we started recording, was about that it's given me an appreciation for just literally just walking out of bed. There were so many years where all I wanted to do was have a night's sleep and then walk out of bed, and it was just was impossible. And I just appreciate that, and appreciate so much of just the little things in life. And I think that people that have gone through life just with no health problems, just taking so much for granted. I definitely see that with runners as well, and people doing extreme endurance events. I just wondered what else, what are the positives that it's brought you? You said it had changed you as a person and made you tougher, but are there any other ways in which it's enriched your life?
I think, like, taking it day by day, not... even when people have asked me in the past, like, what do you want to achieve next? I don't ever have like main goals that I try and work towards.
That was going to be my big last question, James.
Like, I don't ever have like massive things that I wanted to achieve from it. Like, I always am very quite spontaneous. I don't set myself like big goals with it. I've always just been quite spontaneous, turn up, see what feels right at the time, go with those things, say no to other things, and just see where I go. Like, I feel that having like something that feels quite a long way off doesn't help me. So I'm very much take things day by day and just see how things go. Like, I quite like not knowing what's going to happen. And some people absolutely hate that. Like, but I think that comes from running your own business a bit. Like, if you work for someone else, it's a completely different mindset to when you're working for yourself. You have to be very self-motivated and resilient is a good word, and go with the flow with things. Who knows what's going to happen? Like, I don't really know where I'm going to be in 3 or 5 years time. No idea. And I quite like that. Like, some people would absolutely hate that. They're in their job and they're like, well, I want to get my boss's job in 5 years time. I don't have that. I don't think like that at all. Like, I quite like not knowing where I'll be. I actually thrive from that a bit.
Yeah. So now you've described it like that, I realize that I'm exactly the same. And I think that part of that is a result of the illness. So one of the things that was the hardest thing for me when I was ill and then going through my osteoarthritis was I had all these plans. I was going to be running this and doing this, and I was going to, and it's the grief for me, a large part of the illness was the grief of giving up the future that I'd had planned out. And now I think I am much more, I don't plan things, and it is exciting to see, I don't know where I'll be in a few years' time or what I'll be doing. Do you think the illness was a bit of a catalyst or something for coming out with that, not making those long-term plans?
I think a little bit, yeah, because, I mean, I was always like it with, I mean, I guess with golf, like, my whole ambition was to be a pro and be on TV. So I guess I had that like long-term goal. I was never great at setting like little, you know, I want to get to this handicap or I want to do this. So I was all, I feel like I've always been a little bit like that where, and you know, when I won something, like I was saying, I'd always be like, well, okay, let's watch, what can I win next? So I feel like I'm, that probably is my personality a bit. Like, I'm not a huge planner. And that's been helpful to me. I don't set like goals that I need to achieve, which might also hinder me a bit, but I find it a bit overwhelming if I do things like that. And yeah.
But I mean, you have achieved a lot with all your massive following. You've got a book that I presume did really well. I still see it shared and still share it for people. So is there any plans coming up that you do have in the pipeline? Is there another book? Are we going to get a Delicious Liella food line, factories, apps?
So I haven't got any, like, I haven't written another book. I think because of like Ireland over the last 18 months, a book is like insanely intense. Like, it's really probably not talked about a lot by people, but it is a lot of work, a lot of work.
Just the whole different factors with the words and the photos and
yeah, bringing it. Well, it's more about bringing 80 plus recipes together in one place that kind of sync together. They work. You know, it's a lot of recipe testing. It's a lot of editing and things like that. So it's a lot that goes in. It's a year-long process minimum. Like, it can be 2 or 3 years for people. So it's really intense. So I haven't done another one at the moment. And in terms of like products and things like that, it's a really difficult space to be in food-wise. I guess it's difficult because when you look at the people that are doing well in the food space, like the big names, Delicious Liella, Jamie Oliver, they bring out books every year, but they also have big teams that work around them, and they're not really as involved as you'd think in those books and stuff. So bringing out products is really difficult. Like, it's Louisa, my wife, works in food and products, and it is insanely tough to get into. So, and you need be heavily invested in. And I think also when it comes to cafes and restaurants and stuff like that, my energy is just not there to give something. And I think, like we were talking earlier about me knowing what's good and what's not for me, doing those type of things, I don't think would be good for me. Not right now, anyway. Like, I'm just not going and because I'm a bit of a perfectionist and control freak, opening a cafe or bringing out a product like that, I think might do me more harm than good. So it's quite hard when running a business that one of your main directions is that, and you feel like health-wise will be difficult to pull it off. But I also think that's good that I understand myself like that, because a lot of people would strive and push towards that and then probably regret it.
And probably burn out completely.
Yeah, burn out and not enjoy it. And you'll lose love for it. So it's, yeah, it's a difficult balance to get, really.
Thank you, James. What is the best way to follow you? Do you want us all hounding you on Instagram and messaging you and commenting, or should we just sign up for your email and then you can send us out our recipes as and when?
Both is good. Like, I'm like I said, I'm in a transition of social media at the moment, figuring out like how I sit for the next few years. And I feel like I'm going to be a lot more focused on the website over the next like couple years. So yeah, social media is Healthy Living James on Instagram, Facebook and TikTok. And then the website, I send out a weekly, well, two new recipes every week via the email. And there's some other information about me. And then obviously the book you can get on Amazon or Waterstones, places like that. And I've also got an ebook that I brought out about two, three months ago, which was around an Instagram recipe series that I did, which was easy dinners you'll actually make, because since becoming a dad, it's cooking dinners is actually really hard work. So yeah, I did an ebook that was around 20 dinners, the, you know, ones that you'll make all the time. And you can get that on my website as well.
I mean, I feel all your recipes are ones that we make. They're not overcomplicated. Yeah. They're not, no, you're all not going to be standing there for hours, are you?
No. I mean, the whole concept was that if I could make them sitting down in the kitchen, then anyone can make them. So all my recipes are very easy. I just focus that one around dinners specifically, to make them as easy as possible. And also I'm part of an app, a food app as well, called Plate Up, which when they approached me, I absolutely loved it, because essentially, like, I've got 60 of my dinners on there, and it's an app where you go on, you pick, okay, I want these 5 dinners from James, and then it adds them directly into your basket, that then you can check out with Tesco, Sainsbury's, Ocado or Waitrose, and they deliver them to your door. I mean, if something like that was available for me when I was really ill 12 years ago, it would have been like mind-blowingly helpful. Like I said before, I was getting supermarket ingredients delivered, but when you can actually get all the recipes for certain recipes without having to use the brain power of like, okay, I need tomatoes, finding it on Tesco, tomatoes, you know, it all does it for you. Everything's done for you. And then you can get them all the ingredients delivered and then just cook the recipes. So that's a really helpful app that I'm involved in as well.
Fantastic. And just thinking of the people that are still chronically ill. Yeah. I mean, do you find that the people that are following you and buying your books, that they are people that have health issues? Because I kind of feel like if you went onto your Instagram, it wouldn't really be obvious that that you'd been ill, or that these were specially curated recipes for a specific diet. They're just nice food, aren't they?
Yeah, it's been quite a difficult balance to get, because I have people that follow that are like us, that have been through stuff and have in recovery. Then I've also got people that are specifically sort of got food allergies. So they're either gluten or dairy free or egg free. And then I also have people that don't have any of that and actually just want quick and easy recipes. So I've got quite a diverse range of people that follow. And a lot of those people that follow me wouldn't have even known about like my story of what's got me here, because I don't talk about it loads now, because it's what's got me here, but it's not like who I am, I guess. So it's a difficult one to or hard to talk about all the time, because it's defined like who I am now, but it's not me, you know. Mm-hmm. It's got me to here, but it's not what I am.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, that's also part of like a recovery process, I think, is stepping away from that belief of it, your illness defines you, because it doesn't. It's like, what, it helps to get you where you want to go and the steps to get you there, but it's not like you are that person forever. Yeah, so it's quite a diverse range of people that follow. So it is quite hard, actually, because it would be easier if I had just had one direct target audience. But I guess it's a good thing as well, because it opens up to a wider range of people that are interested in that I can help. Because at the end of the day, I set it up just to help friends and family, and then it grew outside of that. So my main goal is just to help people cook more, really.
And you really have. I'm just thanking you personally for all your recipes and for giving me and ideas and things that I could cook when I thought I would never eat anything interesting again.
Thank you. Thanks for the support.
Oh, thank you so much, James. I'll put all the links into the show notes, but thank you so much for your time and sharing your story today.
I appreciate being on and sharing everything with others, and hopefully, I would say, it can help others going through the same or inspire others as well.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Resilience Rising podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do help people find us by hitting subscribe, leaving a review, or sharing us with others. Thank you so much, and see you next time on the Resilience Rising podcast.